So you want me to take it away?
Yes, go right ahead.
All righty then. Okay, well, I'm very happy to be here. I'm Deborah Kendrick, and I probably know a number of you. I'm Deborah Kendrick, and I'll tell you a little bit about myself and how I came to write this particular book we're going to talk about. I've been a professional writer most of my adult life. I knew from the time I was 7 or 8 years old that I wanted to be a writer when I grew up, but you don't go to college to learn how to be the all-American novelist. And so in my early years, I was teaching. I taught college English for a while and worked with blind children and taught in a rehab facility for blind adults. And then I had my first baby, and I did not want to go back to teaching anymore, and we needed two incomes. And so I decided it was time to figure out how to make this writing idea materialize and how to turn it into an income. So I sort of hunkered down and read everything I could read about writing, marketing your writing, and was very fortunate that the first article I sent off to a magazine was purchased. I always say if that first one had not been purchased, I might have gone into something else because I don't take rejection well, but I was very fortunate. So over the years, I've had a very satisfying career. I've published probably thousands of articles at this point. I was a newspaper columnist from 1986 to 2016 when I had a medical incident that led to this book. So I stopped writing the column, but my column appeared in a number of newspapers, primarily the Cincinnati Enquirer and the Columbus Dispatch, both in Ohio. But it was syndicated by King's Feature and ran in a number of other papers around the country for a time. I've written for a number of magazines, Woman's Day, Parenting, Marriage and Family, Executive Lifestyles, Ohio Magazine, St. Anthony Messenger. I don't know, a lot of them. I've written a number of books for the AFB Press back in the 90s. I wrote a series called Jobs That Matter. I created a magazine called Tactic that was read around the world. It was our first real magazine on access technology for blind people, and that I edited that from 1985 to 2000 when it was purchased by AFB in order to introduce Access World, and of course I've been part of the Access World staff since that time. So I write frequently about technology, but I'm more interested in writing about people, honestly, than technology. So I write a lot of people profiles for Access World and have been doing a series since the beginning of 2019 called Employment Matters, because we all hear about the 70% of unemployed blind people. But I want to look at the 30%. I want to look at the 30% and see what makes those of us who do work, how does that happen? And how can those of us who do work benefit those who are not yet working? So that's been a really fun series. If anybody has any ideas, people you think I should profile in that series, I'll give you my contact information at the end, and I'd love to hear from you. So in 2016, well, this wasn't my first medical encounter. But for the most part, I've led a pretty healthy life. I had cancer twice as a child, which is the reason for my blindness. And I think that may have had something to do with my wanting to write this book, because I had such miserable, miserable memories of being in hospital as a very young child. And when my own three children were growing up and they had hospital instances, I was so pleased that hospitals have come a long way and realized that children need their parents nearby. But I also realized that particularly if we're blind, we need to advocate for ourselves in medical situations, whether it's on our own behalf or if we're acting as the significant other or caregiver for another individual. And so I say that everything in a writer's life is material. Everything we do winds up on the page somewhere, somehow. Everything that we experience or interactions that we have or people that we meet, it's all potential material. So at the end of 2016, I had a really unfortunate incident. I had had cancer in 2003, and I survived the cancer, but I had a weakened leg as a result. That's the short version. And that the bone in that leg, I was told, would always be vulnerable, but it suddenly snapped in 2016. And that led to a lot of interactions with medical professionals, surgeons and nurses and nursing aides and physical therapists and occupational therapists. And I know that this will come as no surprise to any of you, but I grew so weary of all of this had to do with my leg, and yet every initial interaction began almost every single time, every encounter with, so exactly how much can you see? So I believe in educating people, and sometimes we all grow so weary of that, and it's so tempting to just be a smart aleck or be rude. And sometimes I'm not perfect, but I like making jokes about it, and I like even better just kind of dodging that question and talking about what's more important. So with so many, with three and a half years now of, something like 5 surgeries, 4 hospitals, 2 rehab centers, I had a lot of experience. And I was talking to Cassell Wilson at National Braille Press, who had talked to me about what books I might be interested in writing for National Braille Press, and we were just kicking around ideas. And I said, I'd really like to write about this whole thing of how to navigate healthcare. So the title of the book is Navigating Healthcare When All They Can See Is That You Can't. And as I say in the introduction, this is not a book about Obamacare or Medicare or any other kind of insurance coverage or anything so dry and boring as that. I like to think of it as kind of my gift, wrapping up all my experience, synthesizing it, turning it into some useful points, and giving a gift to my blind friends everywhere. So I'll tell you a little bit about this. Now, the book it's a relatively small book. It's 1 Braille volume. And it's also available as a downloadable file, BRF file, or Microsoft Word, or DAISY, or a couple of other formats, I think. The book is divided into chapters that are all the primary kinds of situations we might find ourselves in the healthcare environment. So I'll just give you some chapter headings. I'm at the doctor's office, outpatient tests and procedures, emergencies, and hospital stays, and that's, the planned and the unplanned. There's a chapter on for blind parents and grandparents, because in both of those roles, we are often the primary person to speak on behalf of a child who is ill or an adult who is ill. The chapter on managing medications, a chapter on using technology to narrow the gap, and some about filling out forms and that sort of thing. So I think what I'll do is read from a couple of sections to give you an idea, and then talk about some things that I think are major points for blind people to consider with regard to the eventual interacting with medical professionals. So here's a bit from the introduction. Navigating our crazy and complicated healthcare system is essential for anyone interested in remaining healthy. If you happen to be blind, chances are you are familiar with the augmented chord frequently played in the healthcare sonata, whether you are in the minute clinic line for a flu shot, your primary care physician's office for a wellness checkup, or at the orthopedic center for the pre-op education prior to knee replacement, your vision, or lack thereof, is likely to get attention. The recognition comes in a variety of forms. The receptionist pushing papers at you from across the counter might stammer, "Can you take these home to your caregiver to help you fill them out?" Or showing an imagined degree of sophistication, the more innocuous, "Are you able to sign your name?" Sometimes it's almost funny, or would be, maybe, if we were hearing about it rather than being in a starring role, when a well-meaning medical assistant or other purveyor of clipboards squats down in front of you and shouts, because blindness, of course, means you can't hear well either, something like, "Are you possibly pregnant?" Or, "Do you know when you had your last bowel movement?" From technicians who try to help us take off our clothes in the dressing room to doctors who shine lights in our prosthetic eyes, we have all dealt with the phenomenon at one point or another. Whether you are seeking treatment for a skin rash or lower back pain, if you show up with a white cane or guide dog, a perception of your lack of commonplace abilities just might prevail. Even if assumptions diminishing your basic common sense are not in the mix, just how much can you see will probably make an appearance early in the conversation. Sometimes, of course, how much sight you have is relevant. More often than not, though, the misperception by others of what that degree of vision really means runs the risk of interfering with your primary goal, staying healthy. So, some of the things that I think we as blind people, I think these are things that everyone needs to do, but because the whole business of seeing us first as blind and then as humans needing medical attention is more likely than not going to occur, I think it's especially important for us to think ahead, to prepare. So, for example, if you have an emergency situation, do you know which hospitals your primary care physician has privileges in? Does it matter to you that your primary care physician could come and see you if you're sick and in the hospital? So you need to be thinking about that. You need to be thinking about if you have you or someone in your family has an emergency need, how do you deal with specific kinds of emergencies? When do you go to the urgent care? When do you go to the minute clinic at the CVS or Target or Walmart? And a lot of times, maybe blind people don't even know these places exist, but many of these retail stores have short-term emergency facilities where you can, you know, get antibiotics for an ear infection or a flu shot or something of that sort. And when is it, when do you call 911? And again, you know, which hospital do you want to go to? Because if you can speak, they will often ask you that. Here's a little bit from Chapter 3, Emergencies. Life can change on a dime, the saying goes, and any one of us who has had any kind of medical emergency understands that expression in a profound and visceral way. Most of us, after all, need medical care most when we didn't plan for it. Here are some real-life examples that could happen to anyone. Your children are playing on your backyard swing set when suddenly screams lead you to one who has fallen and has clearly broken an arm. Your usually healthy toddler is projectile vomiting at an alarmingly frequent rate. Your mother-in-law is visiting and steps off the surprise step into your living room and has an instant, unrelenting shoulder pain. You feed a guest a dish with walnuts in it, and he, due to an anaphylactic allergy to nuts, is gasping for breath. Or maybe you yourself are innocently chopping vegetables for grilled kebabs when, because you forgot best practices, you slice off the tip of your braille reading finger. And by the way, just a little for your general edification, those examples, I didn't just make those up. I actually, every single one of those happened to me in my life. Those were all from my own real life story. So in classic movies from the 1940s and 50s, we see people in distress picking up the phone and shouting to the operator that they need the police. Readers who remember rotary dial telephones in their childhood homes probably remember being taught to dial zero in case of emergency. Dialing zero summoned the operator to whom you could convey the type of emergency being reported. And of course, now we have 911. Now, some of the things that I'm going to say you might not agree with, but this is my book and my opinion. So I believe that this is one instance when leading with your blindness is a good idea. What you want when you call 911 is swift response. And whether you like it philosophically or not, leading with the announcement of "I am blind" almost always guarantees immediate attention. So some of my suggested kinds of intros are, "I am blind and my four-year-old is having an asthma attack." That lets the operator know immediately that you can't jump in the car to take him to the emergency room. Or, "I am blind and my husband may be having a stroke," alerts the operator that you may not be able to respond to questions about facial expressions. The point is, I think it's really important, and obviously more now during this whole horrible COVID-19 pandemic than ever before, to imagine scenarios and practice drawing the picture in as few words as possible. Practice concise ways of conveying what you need when you make that 911 call. I told you that one thing that led to my writing this book was when my femur snapped in December 2016. So I mentioned that in the book. Here's what I say. When my femur spontaneously snapped in two, putting me on the floor in an instant, I was alone. I used my hands to drag my body backward, out one door and into another room, around a corner, and to the miraculously reachable phone, and I called 911. When they arrived, the paramedics called me to ask me to choose which door to break in order to reach me. I was on the third floor, and they had to carry me down steep stairs to my living room, And I told them there were two things I needed, my guide dog and my iPhone. I carefully explained where each was located and how to harness the dog. Later, it was astonishing to me and to everyone else in my world at the time that I somehow had the presence of mind, because I passed out immediately after getting my dog and my phone and getting safely tucked into the ambulance. So it was some kind of, you know, hyperadrenaline that I think a lot of us experience, that we can communicate what we need in a short version. Because I knew I had to call someone, and my closest relative was my daughter 1,000 miles away, and I had to let someone know where I what had happened to me and where I was. So I think just thinking about those kinds of things. Now, if you are fortunate enough, well, you don't feel like it's fortunate when it's happening to you, but if you have a planned hospital stay, or if you have an emergency, but you're still ambulatory and you can still talk and think things through, think about the things that will be useful to you to have while you're waiting in an emergency room, or possibly having to stay overnight, or possibly having to wait for a few hours for care or whatever. So take your knitting or your crocheting or your book to read, or, you know, I think these days probably absolutely every one of us would be taking a smartphone. So, but think about those kinds of things. And then you want to think about your own elevator pitch, so to speak. You know, in the NFB, we have the elevator pitch. We call it that says what we think blindness is. Well, think about your personal 10-20 second explanation, so that when they say to you, "How much can you see?" so that you know. You don't want to launch into a 10-minute dissertation on your eye condition or a philosophical diatribe about blindness not making you incompetent. But letting a medical professional who's going to be responsible for your care, letting them know in a few words, a few seconds. I tend to say things that are sort of quirky. I tend to say things like, I only see in my mind's eye, or I see what I need to, but I have to touch it, or, you know, whatever. But if you have partial vision, for example, you might want to say, you know, I can see that there's a blue blob over there. Is that the chair? You know, whatever. You have to figure it out, because only you know blindness according to you. And that is actually one of the sections in the book, Blindness According to You. Every human being is unique, and every human being who is blind has a unique experience of blindness. Maybe you love lengthy verbal descriptions of your surroundings. Maybe the only way you can get a physical environment into your head is by exploring it with your own remaining senses, to see the room with your ears, nose, hands, and feet. And obviously this is only relevant if you're going to be staying for a bit yourself or a loved one as a patient, you know, in a hospital or rehab facility. If you suddenly find yourself in the role of hospital patient, those tending to your health will know what you need only if you teach them. While obtaining information that you need and deserve, it is also important to offer some facts to make you and your medical team more comfortable. For one thing, the reciprocal ebb and flow of conversation makes you a more interesting and therefore more remembered individual in the ears and eyes of the medical professionals holding your care in their hands. Beyond that, you may be the only or the first or second or third blind person this staff has ever encountered. You are for sure the only you they have ever met. Again, Thinking about these things before you are in this situation helps you streamline your concise introduction with a thumbnail sketch of you as a blind person. One or two basic statements or requests is often all there is time for, so be sure you mention ones that matter. And I give a few examples of the kind of things you might say that matter to you. You know, knock before entering. Identify yourself. Explain why you are here. If you don't say those kinds of things, I have heard so many times, I once had somebody come in and just stick me. And she was going to take blood out of my arm. She didn't tell me she was going to do it. I've heard so many sad stories of people being in the hospital and their dinner tray was dropped off and they didn't even know that it was there because the person didn't knock on the door and didn't tell them what they were doing. When I mention dinner in the paragraph, I do say, speaking of dinner, one widespread and worn out bit of trivia about what we blind people need is the old plate of the clock face routine. Maybe you are one who appreciates the sight of a person telling you that your lima beans are at 12 o'clock and your macaroni at 3. If not, just say, thanks, but I don't need that. Or, thanks, but it's more important to me that you tell me the food is here rather than where it is on my plate. I think I'll figure that out for myself. So, as I said, I have a pretty lengthy chapter about advocating on behalf of another individual as a parent or grandparent or significant other, some tips on how you might navigate that kind of situation, and some ideas about handling forms. There are some websites for getting information, medical information, and information about your doctor. If you have a new doctor and you want to know more about him. And I think another thing that is kind of sprinkled throughout the book is I think it is essential for us, if we're going to survive in this kind of situation, to be chatty. Not overly so, not talk someone's head off. But I say I am by nature not an extrovert. But I learned long ago that people like you if you talk to them and if you're interested in them, if you ask them questions, and if you offer bits of information about yourself. So you want to be remembered and you want to communicate in short spurts that you are just a regular person. So, you know, when you show up for an outpatient test, you might say, I don't know, I was tied up with my grandchild because her mother didn't pick her up as early as I thought she would. Or if you still work, I was in a meeting and I didn't think it was going to break up in time for me to get here. But some casual reference to your own life, just to draw in a few words that picture of, hey, I'm just like you. I'm not blind. I'm a person who happens to be blind. So I think with that, and then, you know, again, there's a bit of information about medical devices for around the home and so forth and where to get them. But I think I would like to stop there and hear what you want to know about this book or anything else I've written or... You know, the weather in St. Petersburg, which is where I am.
Oh. Well, the other thing is if people want to ask a question, just *6 and unmute yourself and announce your name and we'll recognize you.
William Turner?
Yes, William.
Hey,
William.
Hey, Deborah. It's great to hear you. You sound really good. I'm glad you're doing better. I was listening to a couple things you said. You said that you're not an extrovert, and I'm not either. I know I've had to deal with the health system like you have, unfortunately, but you learn to kind of be interested in what people have to say. I guess that was one of the last times I was in hospital back in December. There was this nurse that came in, and he had a 2005 beat-up car, and he wanted to talk to me. I didn't care about that car, but to sort of make him listen, I sort of listened to him, and he went on and on and on about it. It was his pride and joy, so I kept asking him questions, you know, and I established a rapport with him. Again, I wasn't really interested, but I wanted to make him think, feel that I cared about him and was interested in what he had to say, and that kind of developed a rapport. As you said, sometimes we have to be extroverts, and for me that's hard to do, but they want to, once they see that we're interested in them, they become more interested in us. Sometimes they'll ask more questions, but it sort of opens up a more kind of open door, left communication between us and them, and that can be helpful with, you know, when you're dealing with the medical, with the community, with the doctors and nurses and so forth.
Exactly. Because they, you know, you think about, you know, a nurse might have 25 patients to deal with
right. In
that shift. And let's face it, we want to be the one she remembers or he remembers. We want to be the one that they don't forget is there, that they come check on again just in case, or when they see your light on, they come see you, you know. So if, and I did have some who, you know, would say to me, "Oh, you're so much fun to talk to. I wish I could just hang out." And then I knew I'd ask the right questions. Like I said, asking about things that you maybe don't care so much about. But
Pierce, Barbara Pierce,
hear your voice. Hey, Barbara.
Hi.
I forgot to say that you were my numero uno proofreader of this little poem, and your name is right there in the front, too.
Oh, really? Oh, my. Well,
yeah.
I wanted to say that I think that you read enough of the chapters, the introduction and the chapters, to give people a feel for the spirit of this book. And that is what I think people need to know and need to find something to model themselves on, because your ability to lasso the caregivers and bring them over and make them your friends is, I think, the most important thing that we can do. Unless you can bring an advocate with you, you need to win the staff over to your side, and you model in the anecdotes that you give in this book, you model how to do that. I can't tell people how important I think this book is to give you a handle on how to deal with this problem of dealing with the medical staff in a medical situation. So I don't have a question, but I just want to advocate for people to read this book and learn from it.
Well, thank you, Barbara. Thank you. I had a conversation with a friend earlier today about how praise from someone that you hold in high esteem is especially wonderful, and that is how I feel about that comment coming from you. Thank you so much.
That's how I feel about this book.
And I neglected to say one very important thing about the book, and that is National Braille Press, in response to COVID-19, selected 3 books that are relevant to our situation at present and have made those 3 books available for free.
Okay.
So this book is free until April 30th. If you want hard copy Braille, which I think the regular price is $12, and so it's $6, but they're saying it might take longer to get it because National Braille Press is in Boston, and so they're closed down like everyone else. But it's available in several downloadable versions, BRF files to read in your Braille note takers or Microsoft Word to read on your computer. And those are all free until April 30th, NBP, NationalBrailleProject.org.
This is Ken Crane.
Okay, Tim.
Hi.
Is this going to be recorded, or is it going to be just Braille by National Braille Press?
No, it will not be recorded. National Braille Press, you know, is a small nonprofit, and so the books that they publish are only available in Braille or electronic formats. I've written another book, which is to come out in May, and my understanding is they're producing that one in large print, but they do not record books.
Uh-huh.
But if you have a computer, you can get the Word file and have your computer read it to you.
Oh, okay, great. Thanks.
This is Carolyn Peters.
Hi, Carolyn.
Hi, Deborah. You've got a lot of fans from Ohio.
Yeah, it's nice. It's so nice to be with you all. It's been so long.
Yes. Well, it's my pleasure. I just wanted to share with you, as a past nursing home administrator, I tell you, I wish I'd have had your book at the time. Things have changed so much, and then, losing my vision, it's been 12 years now. And I tell you, I wish I had a book like that then. The plus for me was being a social worker, but I tell you, to advocate for yourself in a nursing home is a tremendous challenge. And as
Absolutely.
A blind person, and if you have to go into one or rehab, I think Barbara mentioned it, or William, you must model what you need. Otherwise, people will never know. They aren't, familiar with it. You know, maybe
You're
not even knowing
right.
anyone ever having, had a disability of low vision or blindness. And they have no clue that you don't, see them. You know, you can have a
right.
cane in your hand and people still think you can see. So it's
right.
the reality of a sighted person not knowing. So we have to really, be that model and educate people no matter where we are. So thank you for your
support. Well, thank you. And it is, like William was saying, we may not feel like talking so much or being so chatty, but you have to push yourself to get that out there so that you come across as a person with individual interests and abilities. I just thought of one funny story that I want to tell you. This is not in the book, but I think it illustrates how we can sort of quickly get the message across of who we are and what we can do. My last surgery was in October, and I was in the hospital for 5 days, and I went from there to a short-term rehab facility. And I was treated pretty well in the hospital, but one problem, all these surgeries are on my legs, so I'm walking with a walker, and so I was walking the first day after surgery, but with the walker. And the rule that they told me was that I had to call for someone when I had to go to the bathroom. Well, I didn't understand this because I didn't have any trouble walking to the bathroom with my walker, but I was totally stable and I knew where the bathroom was. And I figured it's because I'm blind. They think I'm going to, kill myself or fall over myself or whatever, that I can't find my way to this stupid
bathroom. Did you not hear on the phone? Is that why you hung up?
So,
I know,
so when
I'm saying, but I turned my speaker off, and so you still can hear in my background?
We need to ask him, we need to ask you to mute yourself, the person who's talking about turning their phone off. Can we ask you to mute yourself with star 6? Thank you.
It was. I had my.
Thank you.
I did not know you could hear me because I was working on a speaker.
We need you to mute yourself, please.
So, the day that I went from the hospital, the rule was that I had to have someone come and watch me walk to the bathroom. So when I got to the rehab center,
I had no idea you could hear through that speaker. That is odd. So you and speakers are not too late.
Ma'am, we can still hear you.
I was on the computer because I'm trying to organize an event.
Can I have you mute yourself?
I know. I am so, so sorry. I have
You're
no
fine.
Idea.
You're, I think if there's two phones in the house, you only have to mute one of them.
I think she.
Go ahead, Ms. Deborah. I'm sorry.
Okay, that's okay.
No, I had muted them. They're on mute.
No, you're not muted yet. Anyway, so when I got to the rehab center, they came out and got me in a wheelchair, as they will do in these places, and I was okay with that. And I carried the walker on my lap, and they took me up to my room. And when we got to the room, I stood up with my walker, and I said, I didn't give anybody a chance. I didn't ask for permission. I stood up and with my walker, and I said, hey, you're going to have to indulge me for a minute here, because the way I see a room is to walk around it. I have to touch things and see things with my feet. So I'm just going to walk around this room and find out what's what, since this is where I'm going to be sleeping. And I just started walking as I was saying it. And so I encounter a piece of furniture, and I touch it, and I say, oh, okay, I see. Here's the dresser. Okay, here's a chair. Oh, here's the bed. This is cool. And these three people are standing back. They probably had their mouths hanging open, but I don't care. And so I just kept going around the room, and the best part was then I touched a door, and I said, oh, what's this door? And they said, well, that's your bathroom. And I said, perfect. I need it. And I went into the bathroom and shut the door. It never got on their radar. They didn't know that in the hospital I was supposed to ask permission. And since I just went into the bathroom when I found it, it never came up. Thank God, because I was there for a week. You know, it would have been horrible if I had to ask somebody to be my mommy every time I had to go to the bathroom. So, I think just things like that, just taking our lives into our hands. I mean, they are our lives, after all. And, you don't want to do anything dangerous. But in that situation, I knew I'm in the room. You know, there's no cliff to fall off. I'm just going to walk around the room and see what's up. So, anyway.
This is Vern Jensen. Can you hear me?
Yes.
I can. Hi.
Hi. How are you? I'm with the Red Rocks chapter here in Utah. And I had an experience where my neighbor came over and said, there's something wrong with my husband. Can you come take a look at him? a look is the wrong expression. So I went over and started asking him some questions. You know, can you raise your right hand? Can you raise your left hand? And it became obvious to me that he was having a stroke because... he thought he was lifting a hand or lifting a foot, and he wasn't. So I told his wife, go ahead and call 911. When they arrived, they put me in the back of the ambulance, and we went to a hospital. And when we arrived there, they started asking me a lot of questions about his health history. And I said, I'm not one of his... I don't know his health history, and by the way, I'm blind. And it was the first time that they realized that I had a vision impairment. And
that's great.
So they were at that point. I said, by the way, you know, don't tell me any personal history about this guy. I don't have HIPAA. information about him. Wait for a few minutes. His wife is going to arrive, and she can tell you all that information. But at that time, they had actually connected us with remotely with a doctor in Salt Lake City who was on television, and we went through a number of things. But it was surprising to me that we got as far as we did before he really realized that I couldn't see.
That's great. You know, when I was a teenager, I've been completely blind since I was 5 years old. And when I was a teenager, I had to have some work done because for a prosthetic eye to fit properly. And so I had a patch on my eye. And we were actually in a hospital waiting room somewhere. I think my grandmother was in the hospital. I was a kid. I was like 15, 16. I was with my parents. We were in a waiting room, and I remember that I was knitting, and then I put my knitting down, and I got up to go to the bathroom, and when I was in the bathroom, as I was coming out, this woman saw me walking through the bathroom, and she said, "Oh, honey, what happened to your eye?" And I said, "Oh, it's going to be fine. It's going to be fine." And she said, "But you can see just fine with the other one, right?" And I said, "Yeah, pretty much." Because it was clear to me that it made her feel better to think that I was only blind in the eye that had, you know, because while the surgery was done, it was covered with a patch. That was the thing. I had the patch over my eye. And so she thought that I could see just fine out of the other eye, and it made her feel better. And sometimes I don't fib. I don't lie. But I do because of that, and just that story that you just told. Like, sometimes it makes people so much more at ease if they think you can see a bit or if they don't catch on right away. So, you know, I'm not recommending anybody that you fib. But, you know, if it's not an important topic, certainly don't you be the one to bring it up. And, you know, until it's relevant, so... Anyway, so thank you for sharing that.
Hi, Deborah. This is Suzanne Turner from Ohio as well. How are you?
Hi. Oh, it's so nice to have all my Ohio family here. I miss you guys.
Oh, we miss you too. I've really, really enjoyed the book, and I wish I, you know, many times I've been in the hospital and to the hospital, you know, hearing other people's perspectives and experiences since seem to help, but I want to share an experience I had back in March with you and with the others. So I was in the hospital,
sure.
I had pneumonia, and so they also asked me not to get out of bed so they could walk me to the bathroom, and I explained to them the bathroom was about 4 feet away. I know how to get up and go around the corner and go to the bathroom. So about 3 hours later, when I tried to get up and go to the bathroom, alarms went off. The bells went off over bed, which I did not know. So they had put alarms on my bed without me knowing it. And so when I got put my feet back in the bed, I said, I know that they did not do this to me. So I said, well, let me try it again. Maybe, you know, I'm just dreaming. I did it again, and it went off again. And so they snuck in some kind of way and put bells on my bed, so they could know when I, you know, wanted to get up to go to the restroom. It was so humiliating and embarrassing to me.
Yes.
Finally, they did take it off, but they still were, like, just always jumping and coming in to make sure that I was okay. And they just do not understand that we're capable of walking miles and feet and yards and what have you, and just going to the bathroom, which is about 4 feet away, it's not going to cause us to be harmed. So thank you for the book, and I'm glad you're doing better, and it's good to hear you.
Thank you. And thank you, Suzanne, for sharing that, because that is something that we are all very likely, unfortunately, to encounter, because that's pretty popular in hospitals now. And those alarms are intended for people who have dementia or are heavily medicated and might become confused. So again, it's the misconception of blindness that leads someone to inappropriately put one of those alarms on someone who is, you know, otherwise able-bodied and able-minded. The other feature of that sort, and I've never had anybody put one of those alarms on me, thank goodness, but this last experience, I had an extra bracelet on my wrist. Well, I had three, and I asked somebody what they were. Well, one is the patient bracelet that identifies who you are and with all your numbers, and one was an allergy bracelet that listed all my allergies. Okay, that was cool. The third one said that I was a fall risk, and I said, I'm not a fall risk. I walk with a walker, but I'm very stable. I am not a fall risk. And they kept insisting that I was, and so when somebody came to visit who could see, I asked them which one said fall risk, and we cut it off and threw it away. So,
good for you.
Yeah, so, I guess it's important if someone else is likely to be with you to talk things out with another person, because obviously we wouldn't want someone who was so heavily medicated that they were confused to do what I did. But, you have to know your own boundaries and so forth.
This is really helpful. Yeah.
I want to give the contact. Oh, hi, Renee.
Oh, hi. I just want to make a comment that a lot of the things that you're mentioning in the book, and I have not read the book, and I look forward to that doing so, I wish were things I had to apply to other situations in life besides the healthcare situation. When I think of when I was younger, some of the times that I encountered things that I did not know my voice at that time. And I think that some of the things that you're mentioning here are knowing your voice and knowing, you know, your rights and what you want and what kind of life you want to live and being able to speak it. I think there's some things that would be really helpful to me in other situations other than the medical field.
That is music to my ears, Renee. Thank you. That makes me very happy.
Thank you.
I will give and I'll tell you a couple things about the website, too. Now, National Braille Press, of course, is a very accessible site. However, there's a couple funky things about it that people get hung up. So if you go to www.nbp.org, you first want to look for the bookstore link. If you just search for books, unfortunately, you won't find them on that initial page. So find the bookstore link, and then you can start browsing the bookstore. The name of my book is Navigating Healthcare When All They Can See Is That You Can't. You don't have to put that big, long name in. If you just put in Navigating, it will probably come up. And I want to share with you that in addition to my book, as I said, there are three books that National Braille Press has made free to anyone to download until April 30. And the other two are Dinner Delivered, which was written by Kim Loftus and Chris Grabowski. And Dinner Delivered is about all of those delivery apps that you can, you're having groceries deliver or having restaurants deliver. So it talks you through using them on your smartphone or your computer. And the third book is called Getting Visual Assistance with Your iPhone, and that's written by my friend Judy Dixon, who has written a number of books about, particularly about iPhone apps and so forth. And it's about the number of apps that you can use to identify objects and read print and identify products and all sorts of all kinds of things with the iPhone. But anyway, all three of those books are free until April 30. If you go there, as I said, go to the bookstore link, then begin searching and add books to your cart. It won't show up that they're free until you go to checkout. So, and I'll give my email address so that if anybody has trouble or you want more information or whatever, you can contact me. It's kind of long, unfortunately, but it's Kendrick, K-E-N-D-R-I-C-K, dot Deborah, D-E-B-O-R-A-H, at gmail.com. And since you've got Barbara, Barbara always knows where to find me. And I should have given the National Braille Press phone number as well. They do take phone orders, too. 800-548-7323.
Well, Deborah, we appreciate you so much speaking today. It's been very helpful, and I definitely want to get your book. I haven't done that yet, but I will make that a priority. But it's something we all need to hear and learn to have our voice about, and I think the comments have been really great. Judy, do you have the date for the next conference call? Or... I don't think I do yet.
I do not. I'm not sure if there is another one. Maybe Robert, you know?
Ruth Sager, I'm here. And I don't have a specific date just yet. I'm working on pinning down a date.
Okay.
So as soon as I have it, it will be... I'm trying to get it so that Robert will have it for the May calendar.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
So, and I just had one question. I was a little bit... late in coming, I apologize. I wondered if, Deborah, if you are planning on putting this book in print, because I do think for people who work, particularly in nursing homes and rehabilitation centers and in hospitals, or for students who are training to be nurses, that this could be a must-read book.
My editor... National Braille Press said the same thing. But she said as soon as it was finished, she was sending it to her doctor. So, I've had a couple of people write to me and say that they bought or now got free a downloadable version and shared it with a doctor. And I don't see any reason why you couldn't do that. But it's not in hard copy print. It's only, but so many people are reading on their Kindles and so forth that
yes.
I think it would not be off-putting to a medical professional if you were to present them with an electronic version. So, and thanks for saying that and for asking that. So I am going to say thank you to all of you for having me, and I need to go because I have to do this again in just a few minutes for NSB New York. So I'm going to leave and go get something to drink. And
all righty. For you.
All right.
We appreciate it.
That was great.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
Sure.
Bye.
Okay. And Robert, are we recording this?